ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT Radio, we discuss how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we also discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest for humans and also the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, if you're concerned about your own health, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with historian and writer James McWilliams. His books include Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly, and A Revolution in Eating, How the Quest for Food Shaped America. You may have also seen his writing on New York Times, The Washington Post, Travel and Leisure, The Los Angeles Times, and many others.
That's coming up a little later on the show, but first some news. People of the United States consume more meat than any other country in the world, about one-sixth of the total, even though we're less than one-twentieth of the world's population. But that's changing. According to a recent report by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, meat consumption is over 12% less in 2012 than it was in 2007, just 5 years ago. Beef consumption has been in decline for the last 20 years. The last 5 years has seen a drop in chicken and pork. The USDA projects that Americans are expected to eat 500 million less chickens in 2013 than they did in 2006, and almost 500,000 fewer cows, 12 million fewer pigs next year compared to a peak in 2007, and about 20 million fewer turkeys since a peak in 2008. There are a number of factors which are contributing to this decline. Some meat producers say it's due to growing exports, which make less meat available for Americans to buy. But I haven't seen any empty meat counters in supermarkets lately. Some say the growing production of ethanol has caused feed costs to rise. Rising prices might be due to drought, the recession. But the biggest factor is Americans are eating less because they want to eat less meat. We spend a smaller percentage of our money on food than any other country. American hamburger is the cheapest convenience food there is. The federal government has a history of heavy subsidies for meat production. It's estimated that without federal subsidies for water and livestock feed, hamburger would cost over $30 a pound. The rise of flexitarianism, an eating style that reduces the amount of meat without going vegetarian, was one of the top consumer health trends in 2012. More and more people are learning of the horrific abuses animals face on factory farms. More people are learning about the dire environmental consequences of our country's meat-based diet. More people are learning about the many health benefits of a plant-based diet, and are making the choice to a compassionate and healthy vegetarian diet. A 12% reduction in meat consumption in just 5 years is significant. We still eat way more meat than is good for us or the environment, not to mention the animals. Can you imagine if the decline were to continue for the next 5 years? That's something we could really celebrate.
RedOrbit.com reports that environmentalists, fishing experts, and the Pacific Island nations are concerned over depleting stocks of the big eye tuna and calling for stricter catch limits to help prevent overfishing. Participants at a Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission conference are calling for a 30% reduction of big eye catch limits in the region. Participants said the action must be taken not only to preserve tuna resources but other marine life that are accidentally caught with them. Some tuna varieties are overfished while others are near their limits. The commission, which is comprised of more than 30 nations and territories, including the U.S., China, and Australia, oversees the Asian-Pacific region from which more than half of the world's annual tuna catch originates. Currently, more than 150,000 metric tons of big-eye tuna are caught there each year, and that's too much, according to the commission's director. He states that the catch is too big and that we need to find a way to reduce it by at least 30%. The World Wildlife Fund for Nature also gave their support behind the measures that would limit overfishing of the big-eye tuna in the Pacific Island region. Among the things the World Wildlife Fund is calling for is a series of standardized benchmarks to measure harvest, as well as a set of regulations that will allow the commission to prevent those limits from being exceeded. World Wildlife Fund's ultimate goal is to put a halt to overfishing and to ensure that the fish stocks remain in a healthy state so there is a sustainable supply of fish. A better alternative would be just to avoid eating species of fish that are endangered or fish altogether.
Following an undercover investigation revealing gruesome acts of animal cruelty, the national nonprofit Animal Legal Defense Fund filed a lawsuit in Florida against Hillsborough County's Cuesta Farm and Planchard Farm for criminal violations of nuisance laws. Undercover video through the Animal Recovery Mission nonprofit investigative organization documents horses, cattle, pigs, goats, and sheep illegally slaughtered and sold for public consumption without government inspection. In this landmark case, ALDF represents three Hillsborough County residents who are distressed by health code violations, illegal slaughter and disposal of animals, illegal sale of horse, cow, and pig meat, and cruelty to and unlawful confinement of animals. Florida's public nuisance law allows private citizens to bring forth nuisance suits for the common good, and this case appears to be the first time Florida residents have sued to stop backyard butchers who commit acts of unspeakable cruelty and pose a threat to public safety, health, and quality of life. ALDF's extensive video investigation exposes the shocking abuses committed on these so-called backyard slaughter farms. Animals are tortured, whipped, and starved. Children are present in both the slaughter and butchering of animals. In one example, defendants gutted a pig and dragged him with a meat hook while he was still alive and struggling. Florida's humane slaughter and cruelty laws clearly prohibit such acts of abuse. Similarly, in criminal violation of Florida's health and safety codes, unsellable animal products are discarded on site and pollute local groundwater. Animals are illegally confined in minuscule spaces amongst mountains of reeking piles of garbage. Located in populated suburban areas, these backyard slaughter farms put neighbors at serious risk of disease and cause upsetting disturbances for neighbors. Copies of the lawsuit and video and photos from the undercover investigations are available upon request, and you can learn more at ALDF.org. And stick around for more information about backyard slaughter and the downside of the locavore movement as we have a conversation with James McWilliams. That's next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on ACT Radio is historian and writer James McWilliams. Thanks for being with us, James.
Thanks for having me on.
James, can we start out by having you tell our listeners a little bit about how you got involved in animal issues?
Sure. Well, most of my work as a historian is in the history of agriculture. So, wow. You know, ever since graduate school, I've, in one way or another, been writing about the human-animal relationship, I mean, albeit in the context of farm development. So, you know, it kind of began there sort of unknowingly. The last book that I wrote, though, moved into some contemporary issues, particularly looking at the impact of animal agriculture on the environment. And when I was doing the research for that book, you know, I became convinced that really the only viable long-term consequential option for our diets having any sort of positive environmental impact, it's to reduce, if not eliminate, the production of animals for consumption. And I really, you know, as I was making that argument and doing that research, was thinking strictly in kind of conventional environmental terms. But for a wide variety of reasons, I began to read in the field of animal rights and particularly reading a lot of philosophy. And for me, this was a really eye-opening experience because I entered into this way of thinking about animals that, you know, well into my 30s, I had never before really entered. And I found it to be overwhelmingly convincing intellectually, and it was also, it had a sort of an emotional aspect to it as well, this kind of self-education that I gave myself. And, you know, eventually my environmental concerns kind of morphed into ethical concerns. And it's really, I guess, a couple years ago with the decision to blog about these issues regularly that I've kind of oriented myself, I guess, as a animal rights advocate. And that's where I am right now.
You have a great blog.
Yeah, I enjoy your blog, too. And one of the things that struck me was your recent blog about pigs as moral agents and how we lost that sense of them. Can you briefly tell that story for our listeners?
Well, there is this interesting trend between the medieval period and the 19th century when pigs, swine, would attack humans, and it happened with some frequency. The animals would be actually dragged into courts as defendants, and in some cases the animals would even be dressed up as human beings to sort of create this, in a sense, a kind of charade, a kind of legal charade. And what struck me as I was reading about these cases is, I mean, you know, we have to be careful here in suggesting that the people at the time in any way had a sort of animal rights mentality. They really didn't, but, you know, they were exploiting animals as systematically and as thoughtlessly as many people do today. But
except they kept them on small farms where they were, you know, almost like companion slaves as opposed to the factory farming mentality we have today.
No, and I think that's the distinction. I think you just nailed it. And they knew these animals well enough to know that they had agency, that the animals had intrinsic worth as animals. They were still going to exploit them and still going to kill them. But that connection, that understanding, that sort of intuition that what I am dealing with here is not, in fact, an object was, you know, manifested in these court proceedings as well as in day in and day out life. And indeed, that is something that we have dramatically lost. And I think there's an important story there about how that loss has happened.
And now they've become bacon. Bacon.
Yeah, completely objectified. And the apparatuses involved with that objectification are vast. And I think one of the major challenges is, you know, an advocate for animals is to highlight the, you know, largely invisible ways in which our culture makes it perfectly acceptable to think about animals as objects, even though so many people who do objectify animals have relationships with, of course, companion animals that are quite meaningful, emotionally invested, and distinctly different. So there's dots that need to be connected, and a lot of times those dots are very, very close.
And this whole issue of locavores is, you know, very trendy. And how do you think that's going to tie in with how people objectify or do not objectify animals in the food process?
Well, you know, the last book that I wrote really was a critique of the locavore movement, and one of the sort of largest claims that I make and have developed since writing the book is that the whole notion of localizing the food system, while there are certainly many, many benefits to it, the language surrounding it and the rhetoric surrounding it prevents a kind of systematic and thoughtful ethical critique of what we're doing to animals. There's almost this sense that, okay, we're going to explore the food system, and this is a big part of the locavore movement, know where your food comes from. However, when it comes to asking very serious ethical questions about raising and killing and commodifying a sentient being, the movement will not do that. And not only will the movement not do that, but it has created this kind of huge lexicon, this kind of huge rhetoric, this kind of rhetorical style, where eating animals actually becomes, in and of itself, a good thing. It's good for the environment. It's actually somehow construed to be good for the animals. And my objection to all of this is, look, I mean, here's a group of people who want to reform the food system, who want to take on industrialization of agriculture, but they're not actually going to the most fertile place for reform, and that is to remove animals from agriculture, or at least to entertain that question as an environmental, as an ethical issue. So it's almost the sense that, okay, we're going to decentralize the food system, but I don't really want to sacrifice anything. I don't want to make any fundamental changes. so it really kind of comes down to, I'm going to feel good about myself by paying a little more for this bacon because the animal was treated, you know, oh so well, and it was good for the environment. And so what happens is you have these kind of new fictions replacing old ones. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's really unfortunate because there's an opportunity here to achieve some real radical reforms.
But it seems to me that the new fictions, when they're first exposed and brought to light, they seem transparent and phony somehow.
The question about why some of these revelations aren't sort of immediately embraced, even though they are pretty transparent, it's an interesting one. And I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that when we're talking about these issues, when we're talking about food and when we're talking about agriculture, we're not always talking about food and agriculture. I mean, they become proxies for other arguments. And this is certainly true in the locavore movement. It, in many ways, is less about food and perhaps more about local control, or more about taking an anti-globalization stance on your worldview. And so I think because a lot of times it's sort of like religion in a way, you know, a lot of times these issues become, these food-related issues become proxies for these much larger issues. And as a result, when, you know, you sort of step into the fray and say, well, hold on, wait a minute, let's look at these statistics about how much land would be required if we were going to raise, you know, all livestock on pasture.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, why don't we examine the environmental consequences of that? Or why don't we look at the water required to raise an animal on pasture and sort of do the math? You know, and it's pretty straightforward that it's not a solution. It's not a viable solution, but nobody really wants to entertain that because what matters is that it's not industrial. You see what I'm saying? It's like, okay, all that matters here is that it's an alternative. And that in and of itself becomes the justification for being a locavore because you're not supporting industrial agriculture. The fact that what you're promoting, you know, may work on a small scale but doesn't work on a larger scale is really of no concern because you are at least not supporting the industrial apparatus. And that's very often where the argument sort of dead ends.
Well, one thing I thought was really interesting was, you know, your blog about how a lot of these locavores actually treat animals more inhumanely than some of the industrialized slaughter systems.
You know, I have several posts in my blog on backyard slaughtering and people who have become kind of radical locavores and are doing their own processing of the animals that they raise. And one of the things that I've really become convinced about, and the evidence for this are the slaughterers themselves. They blog incessantly about what they're doing, which in and of itself is kind of an interesting phenomenon. But they really put themselves out there without a whole lot of editorializing. So, I mean, it's this great kind of cache of information. And what I have found in studying these accounts is there's a kind of heartlessness, a coldness that strikes me as in many ways indicative of treating animals worse than animals would be treated in industrial settings. I mean, if you read about slaughterhouse workers, what you will often find are people who are deeply conflicted about what they're doing. And these are people who are deeply conflicted, but at the same time, they're kind of protected. I mean, the way slaughterhouses are designed, they're really designed so that the workers don't feel the full emotional impact of what's going on. I mean, so much so that many slaughterhouses are designed so that it's unclear when the animal dies, so a single individual doesn't have to feel complicit in that death. But nonetheless, these people are still suffering. So I find it really interesting that the people who are promoting themselves as these backyard slaughterers and taking charge of the food system and are saying, hey, we're going to treat this animal with dignity, are actually killing the animals with a certain coldness that I don't even see in industrial settings. And I'm sure that's a defense mechanism on some level. I think, and the evidence really bears this out, I mean, when you love animals on the one hand and then kill them on the other, there's going to be a psychological fallout there. And so this is just a long way of saying that simply because you care for an animal in a small setting or in an intimate setting in no way means that you're going to kill the animal in a humane way or necessarily even be as attentive to that animal's needs as you might think you are being. Very often the beneficiary of these smaller systems are the humans. I would say every single time and the beneficiary of these smaller systems are humans rather than the animals themselves.
I thought it was rather shocking that you pointed out that, like, in a lot of times, kids are involved in the slaughter. And there was one particular incident that you were highlighting where, you know, a man and his daughter were killing a goat. And it just was, like, horrific. I couldn't even read the whole thing. It was like, I can't believe somebody would sit there with their child and stab, you know, and slaughter a live goat and not think about the emotional consequences to the child.
If I could jump in here for a minute, I'm sure what started me on the path was when I was a small child in the backyard watching my grandmother twist the neck off a chicken. That was horrific, and it sure affected me.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's all about how you frame it. And, of course, you know, we're having this conversation and we're framing it in terms of this must be emotionally quite traumatic for children. It's emotionally traumatic for adults. Why wouldn't it be even more emotionally traumatic for children who are often kind of more innocently open to the emotional fallout of these of this kind of violence? I mean, that's how we're framing it. But and there are so many cases of people who are slaughtering their own animals, of them purposely bringing children into the project for, as an educational experience. And that's how it's framed. And the rationale is, you know, I want my children to know, A, where food comes from. I want my children to be able to provide for themselves. It kind of plays into this on some level, and I could probably explore this a little more, but it plays into this whole mythical notion that Americans in particular have about self-sufficiency. So, you know, the ethical issues quickly get subsumed in these kind of what I see to be pretty dangerous educational goals or somewhat fictionalized or sort of hyperbolic fears of relying on others for anything, much less our food. And, you know, this highlights really a kind of hidden downside of the locavore movement in that there is this kind of strange isolationism to it. It's like we don't want to depend on outsiders, which to me is another way of saying we don't want to cooperate with others to create, you know, a larger regional, national, global food system. We just want to do it the way we want to do it. And you see, when you have that isolationism, you can frame this violence however you want to frame it. And so you can even go so far as to say, hey, this is a positive educational experience that I am going to bring my children into and let them participate in because it's going to be good for them in the long run.
And speaking of reform, James, in the food system, there's a college that sort of claims they have a more ecologically sustainable model, and that's Green Mountain College. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about the hoopla that's been going on there lately with Bill and Lou?
Yeah, well, Bill and Lou were the two working oxen at Green Mountain College, which is in a small town in southeastern Vermont. There's less than 1,000 students at this school, and the school itself promotes what they call the environmental liberal arts. And as part of the larger educational mission, they have this working farm. And part of the farm is to use the oxen to plow. They really pride themselves. It's a bit of a sort of a false pride, but they pride themselves on not using fossil fuels to run a tractor. Now, I mean, if you want to sort of sit down and evaluate how important that is, I think you're going to find it really is more symbolic than real.
Well, especially when you consider the tractors and other machinery we were probably used to grow the food for the oxen.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, the oxen certainly are not reaching 1,100 pounds by eating grass. They're certainly getting some imported food, and how is that food produced, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's pretty easy to find the fossil fuel somewhere. But nonetheless, with the oxen, they have this sort of photogenic example of not using fossil fuel. Well, last spring, one of the oxen, Lou, stepped into a hole while pulling a plow and injured his leg. Interestingly, Bill wouldn't work without Lou, so the oxen were, from the farm's perspective, now useless. And the mission, of course, at Green Mountain College is to be, you know, quote unquote, sustainable. So part of their vision of sustainability was to now, since the oxen couldn't pull the plows, to kill them and turn them into hamburger for the cafeteria at Green Mountain College. Well, that decision was announced on October 1st, and within a week, several sanctuaries had come forth, most notably Vine Sanctuary, which is about an hour away from the college. And Vine Sanctuary said, hey, look, we'll just take Bill and Lou, and we'll retire them. You know, I mean, we'll let them live out their lives and in peace. And they're only 10, 11 years old. They could certainly live another 8 years, and we'll make sure that they get the proper medical care. And you know what? We'll do it for free. So we'll just take this quote-unquote problem off your hands. And the astounding thing, and what turned this into really an international issue, was Green Mountain College turned around and said, well, no, see, we practice sustainable farming, so we're going to turn them into hamburger because keeping them alive would take resources, and we think that would be a waste of resources. So, so you have this vivid example of using the rhetoric and the rationale of quote-unquote sustainability to completely obscure the very serious ethical issue, which was, is it moral? Is it the right thing to do to raise animals, exploit them for their labor, and then kill them and turn them into hamburger? Hundreds of thousands of people signed petitions saying this was wrong, but Green Mountain College said, no, it's right because it fits our definition of sustainability. So to me, that highlights how insidious and in many ways, you know, how dangerous this rhetoric of environmental sustainability can be. What kind of sustainability are we advocating if it's one that allows the unregulated exploitation to the point of death of other animals? I think it's worth questioning if that's the kind of sustainability that we want. But nobody's asking that question at Green Mountain College. It's so small that even if you did think that it was wrong to kill these animals, there's no room for you to say that because the powers that be there have pretty much made it clear that they should be turned into hamburger. Now, what has since happened is they've euthanized, under questionable circumstances, I think, they have euthanized Lou and supposedly buried him somewhere, and Bill is still alive.
James, we barely touched the surface of this issue, and we'd like to discuss it with you more and some other ideas. Can you join us for a second show?
Oh, absolutely. I would love to keep talking about this. So.
Great.
Yeah, thanks for being with us, James. And can you tell our listeners where they can access your blog?
The blog is called Eating Plants, but it's found at james-mcwilliams.com.
Thanks for being with us, James.
And we'll see you next time on ACT Radio.
Okay.
Holidays are upon us, and fortunately there are many compassionate gift options out there. One such great option is Vegan Cuts. You can learn more at vegancuts.com. Vegan Cuts features a range of vegan products and encourages members to shop vegan by promoting opportunities to save money while avoiding animal cruelty. That's vegancuts.com.
Join us for the next Vegetarian Society of El Paso dinner on January the 12th. Our guest speaker will be Dr. Michael Greger, Director of Animal Agriculture and Human Health for the Humane Society of the United States. For more information on this dinner, please go to vsep.org, the Vegetarian Society of El Paso.
To listen to past episodes of ACT Radio, you can go to our website at ktep.org, click on the Listen button, and then look for the archives for ACT. You can also download the shows through iTunes on the website.
Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.